You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. What is the secret to good comedy? Hey, Cletus, ask me what the secret to good comedy is.
Hey, Jeff, what is the...
Timing, Cletus. It's timing. Today I'm going to talk about one of the most important attributes to develop for the martial arts, or comedy, or life itself, and that is timing. Although I certainly didn't do a world-class job in my silly little introduction just now, it is agreed upon by master comedians that timing is of the utmost importance when telling a joke. I'm sure the process is not unlike the process of setting up an opponent. You set up the audience with the first part of the joke, then you wait the appropriate amount of time before the punchline, and then deliver it. Punchline. Even sounds like fighting, doesn't it? Of course, timing is of equal importance in the martial arts. I've seen many a young martial artist who was gifted with extraordinary speed. Before such gifted individuals learn the value of timing, they will frequently make the mistake of striking too quickly after a setup movement, not allowing enough time for the opponent to open their defenses. Such people literally block their own punches and kicks. That's timing on a granular scale. It's also of equal importance on a strategic scale. For example, when grappling on the ground, many a fighter has gained a position of control over their opponent, only to lose it by trying too quickly for a submission, rather than first tiring the opponent out, and thus degrading their ability to escape if your submission attempt fails. Timing is of equal importance in all other aspects of life, and on every scale. Let's look at what I think is a cool story from history that illustrates the importance of timing. The year 610 of the Common Era, also called AD, was not a good year for what was left of the once mighty Roman Empire. The empire had shrunk considerably from its greatest size over the last 400 years. Huge chunks of territory, including what is now England, France, most of Spain and Italy, had been lost to Germanic barbarian tribes with names like Saxons, Franks, Goths, and Lombards, which, by the way, means Longbeards, one of the cooler barbarian tribal confederation names. The imperial frontier in the north of the Balkan Peninsula was threatened by another confederation of tribes, Central Asian tribes, not unlike the Huns from a century and a half before, called the Avars, and by wild Slavic tribes as well. The provinces that comprised what we now call Iraq, Armenia, and Georgia had been recently lost to the latest incarnation of the Persian or Iranian Empire, now called the Sassanid Empire, as a result of an ongoing war between these two huge polities. The Roman Empire was smaller than it had ever been and was continuing to shrink, hemmed in on all sides by enemies. The people of the empire had recently been ravaged by an outbreak of the bubonic plague, killing at least tens of thousands. Recent events had left the imperial treasury almost empty. On top of that, the incompetence of the previous emperor, a sick, sadistic piece of work named Phocas, caused civil war to erupt within the empire. By the year 600, historians no longer call this empire the Roman Empire. They call it the Byzantine Empire. But the people who lived there didn't call themselves Byzantine. They wouldn't have known what you meant had you called them that. The term was coined more than 1,000 years later by historians. They still called themselves Romans, even though they mostly spoke Greek, and the capital of the empire was no longer Rome. As a matter of fact, the city of Rome was no longer included within the empire's territory. The capital was now Constantinople, the modern city of Istanbul in Turkey. Despite all of this, it still was indeed what was left of the once huge, mighty Roman Empire. The Civil War ended when a pretty amazing dude named Heraclius sailed into Constantinople and overthrew Phocas, seizing the imperial throne for himself. Heraclius was the son of the governor of pretty much the only part of the empire that was at peace, the province called Africa, which we now call Tunisia. He won the civil war and seized the imperial throne. Heraclius might be the most important monarch and military leader that you've never heard of. Anyway, at first, things didn't go so well for our friend Heraclius. The Avars tried to kidnap him while he was negotiating with them, and he barely got away. His predecessors on the throne had allowed the army and navy to deteriorate to an alarming degree. As a result, his first military efforts against the Persians ended disastrously in defeat. The strength of the imperial military was further weakened by this setback, allowing the Persians to continue their conquests, seizing what is now Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Libya, and Egypt. Egypt was especially important because most of the empire's food was grown in the fertile valley of the Nile River, and, most people need to eat. The Persians then began raiding straight into the heartland of the empire, which is modern Turkey, only stopping at the capital of Constantinople because of its legendary walls. Daunted by this barrier, the raiders withdrew to their newly conquered lands. At the same time, the Avars and the Slavs poured over the border into the Balkan Peninsula, seizing the territory consisting of the modern countries of Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, Croatia, Albania, and Greece. The only reason they stopped advancing was that they too were now looking at the walls of Constantinople, but from the other side. Now, there were lots of walled cities around the world at this time, but the walls of Constantinople were truly unlike anything else in the world of the 7th century. Picture an ancient or medieval type of walled city from any historical movie you may have seen. The walls of Constantinople were far bigger, better, and stronger than any of those. It was also a seaport, strategically situated along a narrow passage of water that ran between the Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea. This is significant because the navy of the Byzantine Empire, based in Constantinople, was far better than any other navy in the region. This means that no enemy could stop the city of Constantinople from receiving supplies by sea. That means that Constantinople could not be starved out. This huge city was the ancient world equivalent of an imperial Death Star, but without the inclusion of any silly overlooked weakness. It was virtually impregnable. Heraclius was able to hide safely behind these walls in order to plan for the empire's comeback. Before he could return his army to the field, he needed to do a lot of reforming, reorganizing, and improving in nearly every area of government. He overhauled the tax system, the bureaucracy, and most especially, the military. He managed to convince the nearly all-powerful church to donate most of its treasury to the war effort, amazingly and temporarily reversing the cash flow from state to church. He carefully studied military history and science, and applied the lessons he learned with a vengeance, raising the standards and training level of the imperial army, which was already high compared to other regional powers, to unprecedented levels. This painstaking process took years, really more than a decade. His biggest weakness was that his new, highly trained army was smaller than he would have liked. But c'est la guerre. Such is war. His first target would be the Persians. By far the richest provinces the empire had lost were lost to them. Heraclius needed to restore the income from these precious eastern provinces. Persia was also by far the largest military threat of all the empire's enemies. He used some of his newfound funds to buy off the Avars, securing at least a temporary peace on that flank. When he felt his army was finally ready, he attacked. He would be the first emperor in centuries to not delegate a military mission to a general. He would personally lead an army in the field. The military success of the Persians up to this point was a two-edged sword. They had conquered so many of the empire's provinces that they had stretched their military resources thin, in order to be able to leave troops in the new territories and hold them. This drastically shrunk the size of their field armies. Heraclius realized that he couldn't copy the Persians and try to reconquer the lost provinces. That would stretch his already small forces too thin. Instead, he must keep his army together and bypass all of those garrison cities and go directly for the Persian field armies and defeat them, forcing the Emperor of Persia to negotiate a peace. This was a hugely audacious plan, marching outnumbered into the heart of the enemy's lands and attacking. That hadn't been done in this region in almost 1,000 years, specifically since Alexander the Great did it. Over the next 6 years, Heraclius conducted a series of lightning campaigns, only fighting when conditions were perfect, and at other times staying one step ahead of the Persian field armies. These campaigns culminated finally in the Battle of Nineveh, where Heraclius defeated a large Persian army, leaving the path to the Persian imperial capital wide open. Heraclius and his army sacked the Persian capital. The Persian emperor, Khusro, was overthrown, and a new emperor quickly opened peace negotiations. And before long, Heraclius and the empire were back in possession of every single rich eastern province. Beyond hope, he had pulled off one of the most amazing military, political, and administrative feats in history. It was a good thing, too, because 30 years of war had left all three empires exhausted and broke. There was no fight left in the Persian Empire, and very little fight left in the Byzantine Empire. What about our old friends the Avars? It turns out that during the war they had reneged on their agreement and besieged Constantinople. But remember that whole ancient world Death Star thing? Yeah, the Avars broke their teeth on the walls of Constantinople, and their power declined precipitously as a result. The three greatest military powers in the region had battled for decades, resulting in depleted manpower, empty treasuries, and worn-out armies. So at this point, you're probably wondering, okay, Jeff, cool history lesson and all, but what does this have to do with timing? I'll tell you. A mere 5 years before the Battle of Nineveh, a hugely pivotal historical event happened several hundred miles south of there, in the Arabian Peninsula. A man whom you all have heard of, named Muhammad, founder of a brand new religion, fled from the city of Mecca to the city of Medina. This flight is referred to in the history of Islam as the Hajra. My apologies to my Muslim listeners for my terrible pronunciation. And it marks both year one, the beginning of the Muslim calendar, and the beginning of the military expansion of Islam. Not long after the events I've described to you, certainly not long enough for the Byzantines or the Persians to recover, the Arab armies of Islam came pouring north out of the Arabian Peninsula, directly into the border area between the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire. And as I just explained, both were ripe for the picking. At any other time in the previous 1,000 years, they would have had to deal with the formidable armies of these two once mighty imperia, almost surely with different results. Instead, the Arabs poured into the vacuum of what is now modern Iraq and Syria like flood water. They turned right and rapidly conquered the Persian Empire. They also turned left and quickly conquered much of the Byzantine Empire, reversing all of the territorial recovery of Heraclius and forever altering the course of world history. Now, whether you believe that the Islamic armies were incredibly lucky or divinely assisted, you must admit that's an example of the importance of timing. Getting back to timing in the martial arts, unlike physical attributes like flexibility or speed that decline as you age, timing can continue to improve through much of the aging process. This fact gives hope to the geriatric martial artists like me, and is one of the few seeds of truth in the tired old trope of the dangerous ancient martial arts master. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.